Subject will be how to include thoughts as part of the meditation. And we'll start with a short sitting. And so make yourself comfortable in an alert and upright posture. Comfortable but alert posture. And close your eyes. And then take a couple of three deep breaths. And as you breathe in, feeling your body as you breathe in. And as you breathe out, letting go and relaxing into your body. And then breathe normally. And take a few moments just to feel your body as it is, acknowledging how it is to have a human body at this particular moment. And then if it's easy, you can relax some of the muscles in your body that might be tense. Perhaps the shoulders or the stomach. Perhaps the chest, the hands. Perhaps the thighs. And perhaps the face and the eyes and the forehead. And then you might take a moment to see if there's any theme or any kind of concern that seems particularly strong for you as you sit here, that is likely to reoccur and reappear as we sit. And if there is some major concern, just name it, acknowledge it, and be ready to notice when it creeps in the meditation. And then within your body, as part of your body, establish your awareness on the breathing. Feeling the in-breath. And feeling the out-breath. And whenever the mind wanders away, just gently, sweetly come back to the breath, feeling the breath arising and passing away, feeling the expansion and contraction, allowing the breath to breathe itself, but remaining aware, conscious of each breath. And as you breathe in and out, which seems most clear to your awareness, the in-breath or the out-breath? And if one of them seems less clear than the other, is there some part of that cycle which is least clear? The ending of it, the middle of it, the beginning of it? Place that's least clear, that's the most likely place where your mind will wander off into thought. Be attentive. Stay attentive throughout the whole cycle of breath. Being on the watch, not to get pulled off into the world of thinking, but resting, staying present for the breath. allowing the breath to breathe itself. Staying aware, staying present. And then in the last little while of the sitting, you can do a little exercise. Continue to be mindful of your breathing, but if you find yourself wandering away in thought or thinking, become aware of the quality of those thoughts. Are they harsh? Are they soft to thinking? Is it happy or is it sad? Is it judgmental or is it approving? Or is it at ease? Is the thinking tentative or is it straining? Is it loud or soft? In a very simple way, notice something about the quality, the kind of voice with which your thoughts are being thought. Let yourself rest with your breathing, staying in the present moment with the breath. So what was that like, to sit for a few minutes? And what was it like to pay attention to the quality of your thinking? Yes? It's a very important thing to realize. If the when the breath becomes vague, the mind needs to be occupied. And if it's not occupied with the breath, guess what it's going to do? It'll go off into thoughts. So to know that, then you can remind yourself to be present. The same thing happens sometimes. It happens occasionally that we're in meditation, that the gap, there's a gap between the in breath and the out breath, or the out breath and the in breath. And sometimes that gap can be quite long in meditation time. And because, again, the mind is not occupied, that's often a place where the mind wanders away. So if you find yourself with that kind of gap between the cycles of breathing, it's very important to stay connected to something physical in the body. It can either be the breath, or the place where the breath is, where you feel it usually, or anything in your body that is a strong physical sensation. Just go to that until the breath comes back.
Interesting to pay attention to the voice.
What?
It's just like relentless. It's like an awful mother or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The worst possible. Driven.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Anybody else? Well, the rest of you already weren't thinking particularly. Yes?
I noticed that the thinking was soft, but I was so intensely interested in it. Which I thought that'd be, kind of yelling at myself, but it wasn't that at all. But I was nervous. I was really surprised at how keenly interested I kept, which was something to really.
That's very interesting. And how many of you found yourself very interested in what you had to say to yourself? I find it, I find it remarkable how interested we can stay. And given especially how repetitive it is. if anybody talked to me as nonstop as I talk to myself, I would, be pretty... upset and pretty bored and paying them to stop or whatever. And, but I say the same things to myself inside this little skull here, and it keeps my interest, I'm riveted. And it doesn't matter that I thought the same thought or same theme for the last, hour, or for, 300 times in the last 24 hours or whatever. Each time is fresh and new, and it's as exciting as it's just as important. And why is that? Yes.
Well, I often have trouble with that image. I mean, I find that most people I know have a radio going almost all the time, have a television going, read a book, go to a movie. And I think it's because most people are intensely bored by their thoughts, don't want to think them, either bored or else uncomfortable with them, don't want to think them, and will listen to really mediocre entertainment rather than be subjected to the unrelenting stream of their own thoughts.
It's possible. How many people feel it's that way for them? That it's a relief from your own thinking to be distracted by music and stuff.
But it's not really a relief. Your own thoughts are a lot more pure than what you get anywhere else.
They're much more what?
Pure. Uh-huh. To me, anyways, they're raw. I don't really like TV, but in my job I watch it all the time, and I just find myself zedging out on that and thinking for more, I'd rather not have TV.
Mm-hmm. And, but anyway, either so, even if you're successfully able to drown it out, it's still going on. And it's still going on with interest. it's not getting tired of itself. It's just, you know, going along and going along.
Where's it come from?
Well, that's the, seems like one of the great questions. But I suspect that some of it has to do with our identification, the way we identify. That we're constantly creating identity or protecting identity or concerned about the threats to our identity. And part of the reason I believe we're so interested in our thoughts is a lot of thoughts have to do with us. But I. And we're very interested in protecting it and creating it and being it and all these different things. And so I suspect that a lot of the interest comes from that. And you might study that. You might start noticing how much of the thoughts are you having are self-reflective. And how much of them are purely, you know, has no reflection on you at all. And even if you think about somebody else, I mean, sometimes it's a comparison or it's still kind of a reflection to oneself. And if, when you do think about something totally other that's not reflective to yourself at all, what's the qualitative difference between self-reflective thoughts of yours and thoughts which are thinking, you know, I don't know what.
I had this thought a couple weeks ago. That's just exactly what you're saying. I had this image, you know, that circus act where they spin all the plates and they try to keep them. I had this image that this is like my identity, that I just have to keep somehow, you know, keep some kind of little buzzing activity going on and keep propping it up. It didn't really seem like what I was about. And I have this fear that all the plates are going to crash if I just stop that. I don't know.
Good to notice that. The teacher, Chögyam Trungpa, Tibetan teacher, he said the epitome of the human race or the human being is one big traffic jam of discursive thought. And then I mentioned that to someone. They came back to me with an image of this freeway with this freeway exit, you know, like these figure eights or whatever. Except that you got off and went right back on again. And then you couldn't, you know. Yes. So anything else you discovered during that little sitting?
Well, it all somehow relates to the fear of death and extinction and not being understood, trying for clarification, and the fear that one somehow will not get whatever granules of truth about any given situation expressed in an articulate way and therefore understood. And this is somehow related to a recurring dream that I've had over the years of addressing a large body of people on an important matter, and nothing that I said made any sense to them, and they just turned away and walked away. And somehow this relates to the ego and the fear of extinction of it that we mentioned here before, and sort of disappearing without having accomplished anything or ever arrived at any solid conclusions or anything else. It's just sort of all this sort of flowing along, you know, without any particular way or pattern or any meaning.
It's great you notice that. And the only thing, that kind of footnote to all that, if I may, is that there's many, many attachments that Buddhism points at, but two of the great attachments that it lists is the attachment to existence and the attachments to non-existence. And Buddhism is supposed to be a cure to both. Yes?
I've been really getting into the Thesaurus and also these Lovejoy novels.
Lovejoy novels?
It's this mystery guy that's going to antiques and he'll say how a real antique will bong at him or ping or. And I notice that my thoughts have a tone like, screeching or humming. I don't know, it's really useful to get more and more specific.
Great, yeah, it is. What we think is optional.
Yeah,
So you should remember that. And another thing that Buddhist teachers like to say is that you don't have to believe your thoughts. And I think that for the unthinking or whatever, maybe that's not the right choice of words here, but for the unreflective or something, it's there's a tendency to kind of really think our thoughts are important and are believable, and that they really count and they really, you know, and you know, who told you that? So. So kind of shaking up a little bit our hard, fast, but maybe perhaps unconscious attitudes and assumptions about what thinking are and what our relationship to thoughts is part of the function of meditation, to look at ourselves more carefully and more deeply. So in the mindfulness practice, then we include the world of thinking and thoughts as part of the field that we pay attention to. And we wait. We don't give the instructions right away, partly because for two reasons. One is that if we talk about thoughts right away, we have such a habit of being lost in our thoughts. We're kind of thought addicts, many of us, that we just get wrapped up in our own thinking if we gave instructions about thoughts, if we tell you to pay attention to it. And also because it's much better to learn about the instructions for thinking after you have some familiarity with mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of emotions, because it builds on that. Now, for those of you who are new, mindfulness practice is very simply the practice of learning to pay attention to what's happening in our life. It's bringing awareness to what's going on rather than judgment or analysis or evaluation or figuring things out or whatever. Just simply noticing what's going on. And we use in our meditation, we use the breath as a way of anchoring ourselves in the present moment, as a way of helping us come back to the present moment, to wake up to the present moment, to develop the ability to stay in the present. But that as other things become predominant, become strong, stronger than our ability to rest kind of more or less easily with the breath, we take these other things as the meditation. So if strong sensations in the body arise, we let go of the breath and the sensations in the body become the meditation. You hang out with that and you cultivate the ability to be in the present moment on those sensations. And you explore them, we get to know them. If strong emotions arise, and it's stronger than our ability to stay with the breath, then those emotions become the meditation. We bring our attention to the emotions. And we talked about that last week. And one of the ways to be with an emotion, part of what we want to do is be with the emotion without getting lost in the story that's associated with the emotion. So one of the ways to do that is to feel the emotion in the body, the embodied manifestation of that emotion, and let it just be there in the body and see what happens. Thoughts are a huge part of our life, and for many of us, we're very imbalanced. We're kind of too much in the cognitive world, the story world, the thought world. And part of what mindfulness, one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to get us to be more balanced as human beings, to be so that our physical aspects, our emotional aspects, our cognitive aspects all work together as a whole rather than one of them standing out more strongly than the other in an imbalanced way. But thoughts are a very important part of our life, and mindfulness meditation and mindfulness practice is not supposed to be a struggle against them. Sometimes people who meditate have this notion that the point of meditation is to have a silent mind and not think anymore. And that happens occasionally in meditation, but it's not necessarily the point of mindfulness. It can be a great relief sometimes to have that happen, but just having relief is not wisdom itself. So, and we don't have to set up our thoughts in opposition to our ability to be aware, to be mindful. It's more useful, I'd say, to be friends with your thoughts rather than consider them to be kind of unfortunate distractions to what's going on. And now there's a number of different ways that the Buddhist tradition talks about being or practicing with our thinking. And I just mentioned first kind of two general categories. One is to be aware of the content of the thoughts, and the other is to be aware of them without giving any particular attention to the content. Mindfulness meditation does the latter. Mindfulness meditation is not concerned with the content of your thoughts. There's nothing you need to think about when you're meditating. But there is also instructions to pay attention to the content. And this has to do with noticing some of the things that you noticed. What's the quality of the voice? Is it angry? Is it sad? Is it tentative? Is it harsh? Is it critical? Is it judgmental? Is it happy? Is it soft and at ease with itself? What's the quality of what's going on with that? And what's the nature? What's the content? Are there patterns in the way you think? Do you tend to always be thinking self-critical thoughts or unworthy kind of thoughts? Or you think mostly judgmental thoughts? Are you mostly have aversion that goes outwards towards other, or is mostly aversion directed inward? Or are you mostly have happy thoughts, and you're completely delighted by what happens, and you feel kind of inspired and content? What is the nature? What kind of things? What are the contents that the thinking has? A lot of the way we get in trouble in our life, a lot of suffering we have in our life, arises out of the kind of thoughts we have. A lot of the emotions we have, some emotions are primary emotions, but a lot of our emotions we have arise out of the way we think about things. They arise out of our evaluation of a particular event. So if it's very important for my identity to have, a blue sweater, and I couldn't find my blue sweater at home today, and I found my green one instead, then I might feel sad because I couldn't find it. So that thought, that evaluation of who I needed to be for your sake, underlied my sadness. And this is just, you can probably think of your own examples of how an evaluation, some identity, some idea of who you're supposed to be or how something else is supposed to be, has to be there first in order for you to feel a certain emotion. So, for example, it's very important for you to win the lottery. Because whatever reason. Not because you like having money, but because the money represents a chance for you to whatever. You win the lottery and you're happy for a while. That it isn't because happiness doesn't come automatically from winning the lottery. Happiness arises out of the winning the lottery because of the evaluation that we have what that means for us in our life and what it means for us in our culture to have money. So the evaluation has to be there first for the happiness to arise. There are some emotions which are primary, don't arise out of evaluation, but a lot of what we have in our life comes out of evaluation, which belongs to the cognitive world, the world of thoughts. So, for example, there's a lot of what goes on shoulds, shoulding. I should be this, I should do that. I should be, thinner, I should be smarter, I should have longer hair, I should be kinder, I should be this. Is there a should that is constantly kind of running the show and constantly kind of motivating how you feel about things and how you feel about yourself? Is there, you tend to generalize a lot. So, or exaggerate a lot. For example, the expression, never say never, or always, always, or whatever. Is that kind of either being stated that way in your thoughts, or is it behind what you're thinking? How many of us think that what's happening, at any particular moment, feels like, the attitude we have is, oh, this is forever. So the kind of exaggeration, You might think, take a step back sometimes and ask, the way you're feeling or thinking about this event right now, who is going to remember it in a week? Or in a month? Or in a year? So like we embarrass ourselves, right? In some way. And, it's a minor way, but we're mortified. But who in the world, no one's going to remember you said that particular thing in a week or in a month or in a year because it was really minor. You think it was important, your zipper's down. You're mortified. But in two months, not even you remember the event. So we tend to exaggerate in the moment the importance in all this. And sometimes taking a different perspective than the one kind of being wrapped up in it is a way of kind of getting a different perspective on what's actually going on. The kind of thought exercise of what would it be like if I looked at the situation as if, I was on the moon looking down, or if I was a Martian visiting or something. Very different perspective than if you're kind of wrapped up in the middle of it. So our thoughts tend to be, exaggerating or generalizations or shoulds or comparisons. Or is a lot of your thinking have to do with comparative thinking, comparing self to other, comparing this and that. You compare yourself. You say, I'm not good enough. Good enough compared to what? So say you're not good enough at riding a bicycle. Good enough compared to what? Compared to a 3-year-old? Compared to someone, who has been practicing for the last 3 years for the the what's it called in France? The Tour de France. You know, what is it compared to? If you compare yourself against one of these great athletes who goes to Tour de France, why bother comparing yourself against a person like that if you just, you know, happen to ride your bicycle once a week? Or, you know, so I'm not good enough also often is that idea is often comparative. And what are we comparing ourselves against? Is it realistic? I love this quote by Dag Hammarskjöld, who wrote, "Humility is just as much the opposite of self-abasement as it is of self-exaltation. To be humble is not to make comparisons. Secure in its reality, the self is neither better or worse, bigger or smaller than anything else in the universe. It is nothing, yet at the same time, it is everything." How much of our life is made up of comparison? So this is learning to track our thoughts a little bit. You kind of, what's the nature of our thinking? What's going on in our thoughts? And a lot of self-understanding and freedom even can come from just kind of noticing this and noticing, remembering always that your thoughts are optional. And so if you're always comparing, do you need to? Is it necessary? What value does those comparative thoughts making, the judgmental thoughts, what purpose does it have for you? What are you getting from it? Is it making you safe? Is it making you miserable? Is it, what's it doing? And could you even, as an imaginary exercise, imagine living a life. Imagine just for an hour living in a mind, living in a body that didn't make any judgments. What would that mind be like? Isn't that an option we have? Or are we kind of so much an automatic pilot? I think many of us are, in a sense. These are long habits that we've acquired. And they take a while to begin to free ourselves from. But seeing them clearly is part of the beginning. So the Buddhist tradition then talks about tracking or being aware of the content of our thoughts and then using wise reflection, thinking about it wisely, carefully, sensibly, and choosing what we think about. You know, if you're constantly thinking about winning the lottery, and you think, realize that, how useful it is to be thinking about that. If you realize how useless it is, maybe you can choose to think about something more useful. Let your mind be occupied by something. Because the way we habitually think, in the long run, creates what the mind and who we are. The Buddhists, rather than saying we are what we eat, the Buddhists say we are what we have thought. If we think it regularly, on, over, and over, and over again, it has a long-term impact in shaping the characteristics of our mind, our heart, and who we are. So learning to kind of choose, I'm not going to do this anymore because it's not useful. It's easier said, I know, than done, but it's certainly one of the things that's possible if we start paying attention. So that's the first half, you know, being concerned about the content of thought. And that you can take as you wish, if it's useful for you. Mindfulness practice, what we're teaching here, is not really concerned about the content. Though mindfulness, of course, will help you become aware of the content. The mindfulness meditation is not concerned with the content. What you're thinking, what the story is, who's done what to who, doesn't matter. But when thinking arises, if it's very mild, you know, you just kind of wander away, you float away because you're kind of, your mind's kind of scattered, then we just come back to the breath. But if it's anything more strongly than that, and it's difficult to stay with the breath because the thoughts are captivating, then they become the meditation. You acknowledge them in your awareness. Oh, I'm thinking. And not to kind of get, you know, carried away on the content, but just to acknowledge the phenomena, the event of thinking. If the thoughts are relatively minor in intensity, then simply acknowledging, oh, I'm thinking, kind of look at them head on, sometimes will just cause them to dissolve. And this is partly because our thinking is perpetuated to a large degree by our identification, by our concern with the thoughts. By looking at it, being aware of it, that awareness and naming it is stepping outside of the field of identification. And so we're not fueling it anymore with our identification. If we don't fuel it, it'll tend to dissipate quite naturally. Sometimes thoughts, however, are more intense. And you note them, you're aware of them, you look at them carefully, kind of you acknowledge that they're there, and they just continue anyway because they're more intense. Sometimes we need to look at them in a more sustained way, sustained gaze, thinking, being aware of thoughts. And sometimes being aware more consciously, more sustained, is enough for them to dissolve. Sometimes thoughts are somewhat regular and strong and keep coming back. If they're very repetitive in nature, and you have the same thought coming up, and you look at it, you acknowledge it, and it goes away, you go back to your breath, and the same thought kind of arises again, then what you want to do is look at what's underlying that repetitive pattern. Because almost certainly there's an emotion or a mood or something which is the factory for that kind of thinking. So, for example, people who plan a lot in their meditation, planning all the day or planning tomorrow or planning their whole life or whatever, that not always, but often, that kind of planning in meditation arises out of a level of apprehension or fear. And if you don't acknowledge the fear, and the fear is kind of there kind of subconsciously or kind of unacknowledged, the fear will keep kicking out planning thoughts. So if you notice what you're regularly doing in meditation is planning, then next time the planning arises, look and feel what else is going on emotionally. Is there something like anxiety or apprehension or whatever? And then if that's the case, then you want to connect to the emotion. You name the emotion, you bring your attention to it, you feel it in the body, you allow it to be there, but you sense it. You ground yourself in the present moment in the emotion itself, like we talked about last week. If you acknowledge and ground yourself in the emotion doesn't need to send up this flag saying, here I am, by sending out these kind of thoughts, planning thoughts or whatever. Now sometimes thoughts are even more compulsive, or just kind of really strong, and you acknowledge them, you see them, you're aware of them, and you may be aware of the emotion or whatever. Maybe there's no particular emotion, but you seem to be kind of rolling along really strongly. Then what you want to do then is bring your attention to what it feels like physically to be preoccupied in these kinds of thoughts. Because it's so easy to get caught in the story, right? But if you feel the physicality of it, you're there for it, but you're not in the story. And if the thinking is very compulsive, it's almost certainly there's some kind of energetic physical manifestation in the body. You might feel pressure in the middle of the brain, or tightness in the forehead, or in the jaws, or in the neck, or in the shoulders, or you feel kind of energetically like there's 10,000 bumblebees in your head, or you feel all the scattered energy. So energetically, you look what is actually happening physically associated with this kind of thinking. And there often is when it's compulsive. When we get headaches because we think too much. You can see when people think really much, sometimes they have, furrows or frowns or whatever, between their eyebrows. There's a physical thing that happens when we think a lot. And we think compulsively, kind of very, very powerful thoughts. So this is what we do. And we're not trying to get rid of thoughts. We're not trying to stop our thinking. Thoughts aren't the enemy. What we're trying to do in mindfulness is to bring a kind of a non-judgmental awareness that can see it for what it is without getting caught by it. So if it's relatively mild, just you note it and it goes away. If it's stronger, you note it for a while. You be aware of the event of thinking, and then at some point it no longer grabs you and you go back to the breath. Sometimes it's very repetitive in nature, keeps coming back, and you feel the underlying emotion. Sometimes it's just, gung-ho, and it's just really, addicted and compulsive, and you feel the energetics, physically, what's going on in the body. And you hang out with that. You sense it, you feel it, you explore it, you investigate it, you breathe into it, and just be with it, without trying to get rid of it, but just sensing it. And you see what happens. Usually with thoughts, if we don't identify with them, if we don't fuel them, we don't get involved in them, they tend to dissipate fairly quickly. I distinguish between thinking and thoughting. I invented a new word called thoughting. What the mind does is it thoughts. It creates thoughts, like bubbles arise. when we get involved in it, that's when we start thinking. We connect the thoughts. We have a thought, and then that creates a reaction, and another thought, another idea, and associated thinking happens. And so usually a tendency for thoughts is they'll dissipate if we bring our attention to them, either the emotion, the energetics, or just them in and of themselves. But that's not the point of the meditation. The point of the meditation is to learn to have a kind of open awareness, non-judgmental awareness, that neither grabs or pushes away from anything. Oh, this is what's happening. Oh, this is interesting. What's happening? Oh, this is what's happening. And that's all. Radically different than the way the mind usually works, of course. So it's an extremely radical thing to do, though it's easily said. So that all makes sense? Do you have any questions or comments?
God, I like that this practice of getting, objective type or whatever, non-thinking, comes to us later in life after having years of sick thinking practice. You can't get this kind of clue at age 5. I got this furrow in my head. You mentioned about having a furrow. I know I was about a 5-year-old kid. My mom warned me about it, 45 years ago. It's sort of like, it's kind of a shame I get this clue, many, many thoughts before, many, many, day cycle before this one. It's unfortunate that it takes a lot of life to be led, be lived, before we get kind of awareness.
Uh-huh. So it's fine to notice that, you wish you'd done it differently before, and but just be happy that you got it now. Maybe one of these Thursdays, maybe in December or January, I have this wonderful tape of John Kabat-Zinn, who teaches mindfulness-based stress reduction, telling the story of a fifth-grade teacher in Salt Lake City, teaching mindfulness to her fifth-grade class. And it's phenomenal how these kids take to it, what they learn from it.
Yeah.
So so stay tuned, I'll bring it. Yes?
Well, I understand about the watching and the checking in and seeing what's going on. But then is it like after the meditation then that we might choose based on what we saw to change, actively change our thinking patterns? I mean, is that where the insight, you get the insight of what's going on, and then later on in your life, the rest of your life, then you could take active steps to change it if you choose to do that?
Yeah, it's fine to make choices to change things. But it's important to do that. I mean, to live wisely, we have to do that. But it's best to do it not during the meditation. Meditation, you're developing the ability to be present for whatever is going on, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, without needing to change it. And that's, but after, once you, other, but use what you learn there, sure, at other times to make choices and to change things if you need to. What's very important from Buddhist point of view is noticing what the intention is when we make our choices of what to change. If the intention arises out of, this is unhealthy for me to think this way or be this way or do this kind of activity, and so I'm going to do something which is more healthy, that maybe is wise reflection. But if you say, I hate doing that, and I'm going to get away from it, and I really want to be something other way, I'm really really attached to having pleasant experiences, and I'm going to choose pleasantness. That intention will backfire, probably. So intention out of aversion or greed will backfire. Intention out of understanding and wisdom will probably only improve your life. So pay attention to your intention before you decide what to do.
I was
wondering
the same thing, but I think I'm so goal-oriented that, I'd be sitting there, and I'd be looking at this stuff, and I'd be thinking, well, all right, now what am I supposed to do with that? thinking, well, so what? So I see it, so I feel it, so I, and if I wasn't going to do something with it, I guess, it didn't make sense. It didn't make pretend that I was just going to see it.
So you might hang out. So that tendency of mind is something you need to get to know better. So rather than believing that tendency, look at it more carefully. And if it's a repeated pattern to think, you know, I need to get something or do something or accomplish something, you might drop down into the body and feel in the body. What is that feeling like in the body? What is the actual physical sense and emotional sense of needing to get something done, of being goal-oriented? Kind of look back at it, get interested in that movement itself. And that's enough in itself. I don't need to say anything more, perhaps. But the non-goal of this practice is to in a sense rest in the luminous nature of the present mind that needs nothing at all. It's our birthright to be that way. And it's, you know, when you taste that mind, it feels complete and full in itself, and there's no feeling of incompleteness and nothing you need to do to accomplish to get anything, to feel complete. Yes?
So, in addition to the awareness and the observation within the meditation, I sort of think of like a cartoon with a bubble that shows what's going on inside the head. Are we trying to move towards that bubble being empty, that there's less noise and less, or just awareness?
We're moving to better awareness. Now, tendency is the more aware you are of all this, the tendency is that it gets quieter. But it's best to take that as a byproduct and not the point. If you take it to be the point, then you're kind of going towards it and you're missing the present moment. And just a byproduct. And it doesn't have to happen. You can be free with a busy mind. You know, if you have to think about something, it's fine. But the tendency is for the mind to get quieter. Not necessarily empty. Now remember, I used to say, we warn you, after talking about thoughts all this time, don't just spend the next week only thinking about your thoughts or watching your thoughts. Drop down into your body when you sit and when you live your life and see what arises out of your life if you're in your body for your life. So that the mandala of who you are includes your body. Maybe the bodies are the center of the mandala. And the thoughts are just, you know, one piece of the big picture. Yes?
Underneath all of this, I see a terror lurking of the transformative process in which I see myself becoming someone I don't recognize. And this is kind of... defended by the ego. And I picture myself, one of the thoughts is that someday I'll look in the mirror and I'll say, who's that person? I don't recognize them. I don't think the way I used to think. I don't recognize them. And I think I'm on this way now already. I don't quite recognize myself as being the same person I was 4 times ago.
A time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. The point of mindfulness is, the basic way of practicing mindfulness is notice what's happening in the present moment. So you described it beautifully. That's all you need to know. Terror. Just become an expert in what terror feels like. Yes?
Who wrote that?
Derek Walcott.
Maybe the point is that you never have been the same person week to week, and the only thing that's happening now is that you're noticing it. That it's the delusion.
The delusion of continuity?
Yes. That you're becoming aware of.
Jack Kornfield gives a beautiful, I think, analogy of if you don't know how to swim and someone throws you into a pool of water, your tendency might be to trash about until you learn that all you have to do is relax and the water will hold you up. So when you throw it into the pool of life, without the lifesaver of your identity. And first we trash about. We get confused and upset and it's frightening until we learn all we have to do is relax. And our life holds us up nicely without the lifesaver. So maybe then it's time to sit again. By default. And when you take your posture for meditation, be attentive that the posture you take arises from within the body. So the body takes its own posture rather than your mind has some idea of the posture you're supposed to be in. So feel the body from the inside and then take the posture from the inside that the body wants to take to be comfortable and alert. And take a couple of deep breaths, letting go of your thoughts and concerns, breathing out and arriving here in this present moment. We say in English, I'm going to meditate, as if it's something you're going to do. But I think it's better to coin a new word, which is that is, you can say, I'm going to be meditated. You're sitting here and allow yourself to be meditated. Allow the meditation to do you. Relax, let go. Let the breath arrive in your awareness. Let the breath speak, you listen. If you find yourself thinking a lot, one little exercise you can try is bring your attention to the middle of your head, between your ears, behind your forehead, area of your brain, and take a few moments to feel this area, sense it. What does it actually feel like there? Even if you feel nothing, kind of explore the area. And then, as if your brain was a muscle, relax it. And then allow it to be filled with the breathing. Allow the awareness to receive the in-breath and the out-breath. Very simply. Being simple as we sit here. if you find it hard to be with the breath as we sit here, what is happening that's making it hard? What is it that's pulling your attention away? Whatever that is, that becomes the meditation. In a few moments, I'll ring the bell to end the sitting. And I'll ring it 3 times. And as you hear it ring, do listening meditation. Allow the sounds to arrive at your ears and you to receive it. And after the 3rd bell, bring your awareness to your eyes. And then with the same receptive mode, open your eyes and receive whatever comes into your eyes without you going out. So thank you all, and please enjoy your week, and see you next week.